Yes, and welcome back to the home of good news, interesting anecdotes from history, and hopefully a few jokes on the way. That's right, this is That's News to Me. It's been a great week for good news, but before we get to the good news, we have to introduce the person that's with me today. And with us today, laying the seeds for our crops of good news to grow, and rearing those livestock of stories so you can consume them and they're not sitting there in Kent and perishing, our leading farmer, just coming back from a long slog in his combine harvester, Buster. How are you doing today?
Oh, I love that introduction. That's fantastic. I grew up on a farm. I think I might have told you that before.
Doesn't surprise me.
Maybe I could do a segment on this in the future about an interesting character who used to work on the farm. He was a shepherd, but also moonlighted as a Nazi.
Oh.
Which is an interesting combination.
That is an interesting combination. But we're not here for that today. What we're going to be here today is to talk about the good side of the news, the stuff that's happening that is positive. But before that, before we go and list off the good news that we found this week, should we start off with your first anecdote of the week?
Yeah, I've got a good little story for you. It's about a brilliant prank.
Ooh. I love a brilliant prank. Just before we start, if you could please like and subscribe to the podcast and recommend it to one friend. And also on top of that, if you have any good news stories that you found out or fantastic stories that you would like to have featured in the podcast, please send them along to Odin. What's our Gmail? callumlennon.podcast@gmail.com, and I will pick it up because apparently we don't have a working email for all of us.
Apparently we do, but we just don't know it. You could send it to us on Instagram, eh?
Yeah, exactly. On Instagram. Send it to us on Instagram or Facebook.
Tag us on Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, let's get on with the show.
So there's a bit of background for your and the listeners' benefit. You probably remember like a very famous prank show, Punk apostrophe D, or Punked.
With Ashton Kutcher, one of the most beautiful beautiful men in the world.
Wow, I didn't realise you felt that way about
Ashton Kutcher, Josh Hartnett and David Beckham, in opposite order. So it goes David Beckham, then Josh Hartnett, and then I'd let them do all sorts.
I go for the sort of rugged Bradley Cooper type. I think that's my sort of vibe.
Okay.
He could play a prank on me and I wouldn't be that arsed, really. Yeah. But Punked, there was a really famous Punked. I thought it was just worth mentioning just to give you for people who weren't familiar with the show, Ashton Kutcher would play a prank on a celebrity and then would sort of reveal it all the end. Haha, it was just a joke. There's a really famous one where he got Justin Timberlake to believe he was being investigated by the FBI or the IRS or something, and they started confiscating all his stuff, and he ended up just sitting on the step of his house crying until they came on and told him it was just a joke.
You know, my favourite one is Simon Cowell, because they basically played a prank on him where they drove his Bentley into some scaffolding and they all fell down and broke his Bentley.
Oh yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And he did not give a shit. I thought, that's how rich that geezer is.
That's obscene.
That he just did not care. And they were like trying to like eke it out of him to try and get him to react. And they're like, oh, is that your really expensive car? And he was like, yeah. Didn't care.
I've got a couple more at home. It's not a big deal.
Exactly. It's fine.
Do you, I don't know if you, because you're a couple of years younger than me, you might not remember this as well as I do, but do you remember the show Beatles About?
More than a couple, mate. What show, sorry?
If you're like about 2 or 3 months younger than... But do you remember Beatles About that was on in the UK with Jeremy Beadle?
No, not at all.
He was a TV presenter. He used to do You've Been Framed and stuff back in the day. Oh. And he did a prank show where he pranked members of the public. So he would just go to random people, not celebrities, do something heinous, and then go, hey, it was just a joke. And he was actually voted or sort of crowned in a national newspaper as Britain's second most hated man after Saddam Hussein.
Wow.
For his efforts.
That's just so harsh. That is just so
just
harsh.
For a prank show.
Yeah. Well,
the people love a prank and they hate a prank at the same time.
Is it because he had a really small hand to play in the suicide bombings?
I think he may have overplayed his hand. So I thought I'd give you a bit of a background to this particular prank show, the one that started all, a bit of history, and then I build up to this great prank. So all of these things, Beatles About, Punk'd and various other ones, started with a show called Candid Camera that was on in America. Yeah. They had the host of it was infamous, he was called Alan Funt. Which is just a brilliant
name. This is going to be so hard to not mix it up. Just like when they're talking about Jeremy Hunt on TV.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of presenters do it on purpose. And they go, oh, didn't mean to say that word. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so we'll try to avoid any sort of Jeremy Hunt slips in this. So this guy, Alan Funt, who's also the creator of the show, so he used to do a radio show back in World War II called The Gripe Booth, or a segment in a show called The Gripe Booth, where he'd get soldiers, interview them, and you know, get them to sort of talk about what's going on, what's difficult, what's bothering them. But he found that the guests didn't do very well when they knew they were being recorded, sort of clammed up. So... What do you reckon his approach was for this? Like, how do you reckon he solved this?
Was it just do it and then apologise later? Was it one of those?
Pretty much. Yeah. He would just secretly record them, tell them it's a practice or whatever, and then he found that the material was much, much better. So he took that idea after the war to try and make like a sort of a prank show.
It wasn't him afterwards that when the war ended, he was just like, it was just a joke.
Yeah.
I was talking to Hitler one day and I was like, oh, Jews are bad. He just took it way too far, didn't he? Not my fault.
Yeah. No one would ever believe him as well, because it'd be like, America's just dropped two bombs on Japan and they've given up. Oh, yeah. So they fought to the death over Iwo Jima and they dropped two bombs and now they've given up. Whatever, Alan. Give me my army stuff. I'm going back out there. That's the technical term for it. So he had this idea he took away from the war, and he started recording secret conversations and making sort of jokey situations. But the thing was, people didn't really like that. It wasn't very popular because, this is mad, there was no reveal at the end. He would just play a prank on someone, and then that was it. Show was over. There was no like, hey, you're on a show. This idea was completely alien. Had never been done before. So he just did all these shows, which people complained about a lot because they felt they were an invasion of privacy, because it's just some guy being a dick on the radio.
Oh, right. So the reveal was actually people trying to show off, like, oh, they actually didn't mind being recorded. They didn't mind all this kind of stuff. Because beforehand, it was just like, it's a TV show of a guy just going around being a right funt.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, before it was called Candid Camera, it was probably just called Alan's a Fut. So he had this idea then he did a radio and a television show, and he had this idea that at the end of each segment, he would say, smile, you're on Candid Camera, and everyone would go, oh, and it's a relief. And I think that, it seems crazy to not think of that before, but that's entirely what makes it, because it's the relief of it not being the horrible situation you're in, and it's kind of funny, you can laugh at yourself, it's sort of, It closes the joke up.
It does.
But this whole like system was totally new, and he invented it, and it became so, so popular. It was like one of the number one shows in the 60s. You know, so up until then, this kind of camera show had been like, you know, Ashton Kutcher going up, making Justin Timberlake cry, and then pissing off, or Jeremy Beadle just like using a JCB to tip someone's car into Grimsby Harbour and then just shuffle off with his hands in his pockets.
I think that's why Punk'd was so good compared to all the other prank shows, is because he was getting people that like normalizing people that everyone admired. Like, do you know what I mean? Like the Golden Globes kind of thing, and Ricky Gervais just poking fun at all the celebrities. It's kind of like, ah, yeah, you know, you're so high up there, you deserve to kind of be brought down a little bit. And I think that's why it was so popular, rather than going after unsuspected victims in the middle of the street and going up and just happy slapping them or shouting and being like, I'm in a library. That's why Punk'd, I think, was so good, because it was like, oh, these are normal people that, you know, we can actually make upset, but also they are celebrities, so it makes us feel a lot better about our lives.
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison, by the way, is happy slapping. This, without the reveal, Candid Camera is basically happy slapping.
Yeah.
So this show was a massive hit, and his catchphrase, smile, you're on Candid Camera, was a whole thing. Very, very famous. So that's the background leading up to this epic prank. So Mr. Funt, Mrs. Funt,
wow,
and their two itty bitty Funts.
Funty kids.
Funtinos. That's his wife and two kids. In case you think that's some sort of street lingo that you're not familiar with.
There you are, the Funts. On, the absolute Funts.
The Funts. They were all in on this, all on a flight from Newark, New Jersey to Miami, Florida in 1969. So none of the passengers were in on this. The Funts on this flight, when suddenly a guy jumps up at the front of the plane with a knife, grabs a stewardess, puts it to her neck and says, you've got to land this plane in Cuba. I want to redirect the plane to Cuba. Everyone's in stunned silence, shocked, you know, doesn't want to do. The hostage taker goes into the cockpit with the pilot who's in on it, who then starts to divert the plane and turn the plane and, you know, change direction. You know, people are just sort of stunned and a bit of like in shock. Then this is where the prank goes wrong.
This is where the prank goes wrong. He's in the cockpit actually telling them to go a different way. They're redirecting the plane at this point in time. And now it goes wrong after this point.
Well, yeah. Basically what happens here is somebody recognises Alan Funt on the plane.
Right.
And stands up and shouts at all of the passengers to hear, wait a second, we're not being hijacked. It's a Candid Camera stunt. Look, there's Alan Funt.
Oh, no.
Everyone just erupts into cheers and hoots of laughter, applauding.
And Alan,
they're all coming over to get autographs for him and stuff.
And Alan Funt's sitting there going, huh? What? What are you talking about?
At one point, this massive ovation and noise in the first class cabin here attracts the attention of the cockpit. So the hijacker, you know, hijacker comes out and to like a standing ovation from the passengers for his great work. You know, they're still believable. It's a, you know, such a brilliant performance. But this is where it goes really wrong. It wasn't actually a prank at all. The plane was genuinely being hijacked.
I was guessing that was the way it was going to go.
Because it's too bad to be a prank.
So hang on a minute. So the hijacker's in the cockpit. They've closed the cockpit. Blah, blah, blah. They all start erupting with cheers. He's probably thinking, oh, they want me to go to Cuba. Oh, look at that. They're all cheering me. Brilliant. Let me go outside. Let me bow. Let me have my flowers chucked at my feet. Let me roll out the red carpet for me. Brilliant. Look how great I am. And Mr. Funt's going, I'm scared. I don't know why you're taking pictures with me.
He was terrified. He's in the middle of a really serious hostage situation, and he's been surrounded by people telling him what a hilarious practical joke it is. He's desperately trying to convince them to realise the risk they're in and to sit back down and calm down. He even found a priest on board and tried to get this priest to convince the other passengers because they wouldn't have any of it. He was so desperate, in fact, that he started to concoct his own plan to try and take down the hijacker before he was talked down by his wife and a stewardess. So he was beside himself because no one would listen to him.
He so wanted to prove it wasn't it, that he'd put himself in danger. And then what if they would have landed in Cuba, would they have still been sitting there going, brilliant. This is such a good prank. This is such a good prank.
Well, that's precisely how it went down. The grand reveal was the plane landed in Cuba, in Havana. And that's when it kind of sunk in for all the passengers. And because people are weird and our brains work in strange ways, they sort of blamed Alan Funt for this. So everyone filed off the plane and just threw insults at Alan because they were like, ah, oh, this Funt guy thinks he's so fucking clever playing these stupid pranks, knowing that it's not a prank.
So the hijacker, did he know Alan Funt was going to be... that? This is his whole plan. His whole plan was...
He
would just so happened... or maybe it was a bit more... he was carrying a knife and he was thinking about hijacking the plane. He was like, maybe I'll do this as a test run, see if I can get a knife beyond. And then saw Alan Funt and was like, brilliant, they're going to think it's all him. And I can just go,
yeah,
and do this. That's.
I could have been following him around for
that's
weeks.
That's an insane story.
And I could hijack him in his own car, but that's not going to get me to Cuba.
And so this guy, this geezer that wanted to hijack the plane, wasn't for any kind of like terrorist thing. I'm guessing he was a fugitive trying to run away from the law, trying to get away. Blah blah. What? Why was this guy wanting to get to Cuba? Do we know?
So apparently, this was a whole thing, hijacking planes and taking them to Cuba. So that Cuba now had all the planes. They had some sort of like plane black market.
Oh, so what happened to all the passengers afterwards? Do we know that?
They were all released without issue. In fact, the Funts, they were honoured guests of Fidel Castro for the 11 hours or so they were on.
No way!
So they didn't have a bad time at all.
They ended up being with Fidel Castro. All because a guy wants to hijack a plane. And they're all sitting there being like, oh, so can we fly back? I was like, no, we've got the plane. This is our plane now. You're not taking the plane back. This is Cuban territory plane. You can get the train back.
And they just repainted
it. Rob them.
Yeah. So it's pretty strange one. But there's another great bit of the story as well, is that... one of the guys who's got off the plane, as he walked past Alan Funt, and he was, you know, they were all giving him shit, one guy just turned to him and went, smile my ass.
He didn't do anything.
I have no idea how inconvenient this hijacking is for me.
Yeah, what a mental story. So we've got a guy that, for once in his life, didn't want to play a prank. He was off duty. He didn't want to...
He was just trying to
go on holiday, end up in Fidel Castro's house because of a hijacking. And they got blamed for it.
We've had that's the worst bit, is he got squarely the blame for it. And we had an update and clarification from Producer Corner about these hijackings, so this is pretty interesting. This sort of hijacking happened really frequently in the US. So between 1968 and 1972... more than 130 American airplanes were hijacked. Sometimes more than one on the same day.
Were they trying to enter into the space race a little bit late and thought that that's one way of getting up there?
Just stick a few too many planes together. Yeah. I've got as well something kind of interesting as a bit of a closer to this, because it's on the theme of pranks, and it just popped into my head when I was looking up this story. Do you remember in 2017... there was a guy who was the half-brother of Kim Jong-un, the current leader in North Korea. His half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, was assassinated in public in Kuala Lumpur Airport.
They used a suitcase, didn't they? And they jabbed him in the back or in the bum or something with a...
That's probably another different one. This one was basically prank related. So he was sprayed in the face with a nerve agent.
Oh, yes.
But it was part of a prank TV show that was completely fake. And the two, sort of, I guess you could say, the unwitting murderers had been groomed for months to pretend they're on a prank TV show.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually were sort of pointed at him, given this canister of nerve gas. Spray that in that guy's face and killed him.
Jesus.
Crazy. So that's the opposite of Alan Funt.
Yeah.
Because in this case, they got the blame when it wasn't their fault.
They didn't know that they were doing it. Rather than Alan Funt didn't know he was doing it, didn't do anything, and then still got the blame.
He really did. He really got the shit end of the stick there, didn't he?
It must just come with the territory, you know? Like, you know when people must, like, meet football players and just think automatically they're a bit of a twat? Just with him, it must be everything. He must be coming in and just being like, oh, can I have a coffee and a sandwich, please? And be like, ah, you don't really want a coffee, do you? He's like, no, can I just have a coffee? He's like, am I on kind of camera?
The boy who cried funt. Tale for our times.
Yeah, boy who cried funt. Brilliant. Let's just get on with some good news. Open your mouth. It's time for the news. Do 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 do. Bong.
So I've got some good news about renewable energy. So in Europe, in 2020, renewable energy generation surpassed fossil fuel electricity generation. So
we're a strong cutter there, but a more, fossil.
Yeah,
yeah,
fossil fuels. Yeah. It's due to declining coal. Yeah. So that's it's great news. It's a trend that's been happening for a while, but in 2020, some studies say that it's overtaken. So 38% of electricity in Europe was generated from renewables, mostly because of a massive increase in solar and wind power, and compared to 37%. From fossil fuels, mostly due to a big decrease in coal burning.
Brilliant. The sun,
which is good news.
The sun's coming out, literally, and helping us out.
Yeah.
Brooklyn DA to vacate more than 1,000 prostitution warrants. Essentially, he's decriminalising prostitution, and instead of sending them to prison, he's going to be giving them like medical assistance, mental health help, any kind of substance abuse therapy, children's services and housing assistance to try and stop them from going into this kind of life of crime in the future, and essentially taking away all the warrants for their arrest. So that's pretty cool that they're helping people out.
That's
in the
great,
worst
very prison. Progressive.
Yeah, indeed.
So I've got another story from the US. Going back to the library is fine. So there's a bunch of libraries all across the US, hundreds and hundreds of libraries, that are now getting rid of their late fee fines.
Brilliant.
A lot of the problem was that people would borrow some books from a library. It's a great resource for particularly low-income people to and families to get access to reading materials, the internet services, things like that. But once a book becomes late, which is very easy to do, I had a book late for years and years until there was an amnesty at my local library. Once it's late, then it accrues fines, which tick up over time. So people are scared to come back, and that's it. As simple as that, their library's effectively closed to them because they're terrified of being tased as they go in with this late book. So with dropping these fines, they're bringing back people who haven't been to the library in ages and getting quite a few books back as well.
That is brilliant. The amount of times I got a fine at school, I think at one point in time you couldn't move on without paying your fine or something, or going to the next year. I can't remember. They threatened us a little bit. But it also surprised me a few months, about over a year ago now, we went into Walthamstow Library, and it just made me really think about other people's situation, because people were in there using the computers for online services and stuff, and I was thinking, does everyone have a phone now and a computer at home? But not everyone does still, and that is the reality
that's
of the
situation.
That's
been exposed in homeschooling, hasn't
exactly.
it? Still, but thousands of children don't have access to computers at home.
That's the reality of the situation. So yeah, we actually need to help a lot more people get online. Probably because people that are online are friends with people that are online. Yeah, at this point, that's not surprising. A little invention, a world first, a home hydrogen battery has the ability to basically warm a house for about 2 days. Hydrogen is the kind of future, apparently, of home energy, and it looks like they are on their way to be making better battery setups via hydrogen for the future. And I think this would probably be the way that we do it in the future, because hydrogen is much less worse for the atmosphere than obviously fossil fuels and other means of energy.
Yeah, you burn hydrogen, you get water as a byproduct. So
brilliant.
It's pretty clean. And I think it's worth watching, keeping an eye on any news that comes out about new battery designs, because I was just reading about how lithium batteries currently made now, and the lithium mining is quite often incredibly exploitative. So moving away from lithium batteries, which are in everything and need to be in everything as we move to a, you know, more renewable energy powered world. We need to make sure we don't ravage the environment making batteries.
And less bunnies going down those mines and collecting the lithium. So
that's the way they do it, yeah. Yeah, some of them, they don't even put a bell on, so they can't, if they get lost, that's it. Yeah. Just thousands of rabbits just down there. So I've got a marine themed story.
That's classic.
Always my favourite.
Classic.
Yeah. So there's a First Nation people, the Songhees people in British Columbia and Canada, have done a marine survey using a remote operated vehicle, like a little sort of underwater drone, of some of the archipelago and islands around their sort of homeland. And this survey has established what sort of wildlife is in the area. It's the first step towards creating an official marine protected area.
Brilliant.
But other than, I mean, those are always great news, but this is particularly good news because it's a great step in the direction of having indigenous people cooperating with scientists and not having almost like colonial science and scientists will just step into an area and protect it. Having the indigenous people have their own environment protected for and by them. It's a great collaboration, and I think the way a lot of these things should be done.
Yeah, and it's amazing how quickly, we spoke about before, how quickly nature bounces back. The amount of damage we've done to the environment over the past, you know, since the Industrial Revolution, really, in the early 1900s. And so quickly, the environment bounced back to levels that we haven't seen for decades, and it's took us that long to damage it. And so just these few protections and helping out these people locally will really help them boost that population of fish. So, Sri Lankan government have decided to give free period products to schoolgirls. They have a really big problem with it. So in 2015 they said that around about 37% of girls at school will miss 1 to 2 school days each month, and you know, just imagine in places like Sri Lanka, missing a couple of days can be really, really detrimental to their education. So they've actually decided to start giving out free products at school so that girls could actually, you know, have products on them and attached to them so that they can, you know, don't have anything going anywhere. I don't really know why I'm going into the ins and outs of how periods work. We all know why periods are things and why giving products to people that are poorer and can't afford products would be a really beneficial thing, especially when it comes to people missing out on education. But here I am mansplaining the workings of a vagina to people, so I do apologize for that. And essentially, free products for schoolgirls so they don't miss out on school because they normally don't have products that they can use from home. So that is a lovely little initiative that Sri Lanka are doing. And we've already seen that from Scotland and other places around the world have started doing it as well. I think New Zealand were the first that we saw. So I think this will build up probably momentum over the next few years, and we'll see that more and more.
Here's hoping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This next story is about Wei'i Man. A blind Israeli man has become the first man in the world to receive a artificial cornea transplant, and after the surgery, which took less than an hour, he was able to recognize his relatives and read text, having previously been blind.
Brilliant.
Because of a problem with his cornea.
Brilliant.
Normally corneal transplants are done with human transplants, so this is the first ever artificial cornea, and it uses some incredible technology to stop it from being rejected by the cells around your eye, and it shouldn't degrade. So once it's replaced, that should be it.
Brilliant.
It's incredible.
Jennifer King has become the NFL's first full-time black female assistant coach. Bit of a mouthful, but it's brilliant that we see more and more women getting involved in the game. And this is also encompassed with the news that they had their first ever female referee at an NFL Super Bowl. It's happening more and more that women get involved in sports. And it's an amazing step forward, you know, even ever since the likes of Andy Gray and Richard Keys getting sacked for saying that they would have sex with an assistant referee that's just started work. And then they also said she couldn't explain the offside rule. So that kind of misogynism, thankfully, is moving out of the game over the last, decade or so. There's still a lot to go, especially when it comes to even like the likes of physios and doctors. There's still not enough females inside the sport. And I think the last female physio inside of the Premier League had a massive falling out with Mourinho and then got sacked for it. So, we've still got a long way to go. But the fact that more females are getting involved in sports is only going to be beneficial for the race for equality.
Yeah, definitely get the ill factor out of major sports. And So I've got an environmental story to finish about a Finnish hockey team who are giving a puck about the environment.
You've been thinking about that one for a while, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Wasn't listening to any of your story. Thinking of headlines. But they're basically this Finnish ice hockey club. They're going carbon neutral. The first carbon neutral hockey club in the world. I think hopefully setting a model for other major sports teams, because sports, if you've got an ice hockey rink with flood-lit grounds, has a potential to be an environmental nightmare. Maybe not so in Finland, it's pretty cold there
anyway. And the amount of times that they've just been skating along and suddenly the ice has all melted. It's been crazy amount of times. They need to go carbon neutral to stop this climate change from happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's places like Finland that, playing ice hockey in Finland may be a risk in a warming world.
Yeah, it's not
they've got skin in the game.
It's not water hockey. It's not what it's called.
Yeah, it wouldn't work at all, would it?
No,
really?
Exactly. It'd be a very dangerous side of water polo, wouldn't it? It's like, at least water polo is a nice ball. That puck hitting you in the face, Jesus.
Although the fist fights in water, I don't know if they'd be worse or better.
Oh, definitely worse.
I guess you couldn't throw a punch as fast, but you could drowse them one.
Yeah. My girlfriend once revealed to me that she loves ice hockey so much because of all the fights. And I was like, I'm very timid. I don't understand why that's a thing for you. Maybe it's just something that you're not, so therefore you love it. But yeah, that's brilliant. Carbon neutral ice hockey team. I don't know how carbon neutral or how much carbon they use up, but I guess that their carbon footprint was enough for them to make a change, which is always a good thing.
It was six. They used up six carbon.
Six carbon. And that's how we're going to finish this segment. So you've had enough of your confused, and that six carbon, you can have it back. Close your mouth, you fool from the news. Do 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 do. Bong.
It's a 16-year crime spree, and the case was eventually referred to as the Phantom of Heilbronn.
Ooh.
And you've got to roll the R slightly because it's in Germany.
Okay, you've already given something away. I'll be able to guess this.
It wasn't given a lot away because the first line of the story is, it all starts in Germany in 1993.
Right, I'm ahead of the game. I was ahead of the game. Right. I already got that bit.
So, a 62-year-old woman was found dead in her home, strangled to death with some wire from some flowers that were found near her body.
Prince Charles.
There was very little evidence since it was sort of a modern Jack the Ripper.
Prince Charles.
Well,
is it Prince Charles?
Here's the thing. There is one bit of evidence that actually rules him out. So there was no witnesses or suspects or any sort of sign of suspicious activity around her home. There was one thing though. There was some DNA found on a teacup near the victim's body. Ooh. That DNA was matched to an unidentified female. So they could tell it was a woman's DNA, but they couldn't. They didn't have a match anywhere. So they were wondering, had the victim known her killer and had offered them a drink when they came to the house, or had the killer just decided to establish their dominance and just bold as brass brew up a coffee or a tea after murdering somebody? But that's where the trail led to a dead end. The case went cold. only 8 years later did the next sort of piece in the puzzle come together. This was in 2001. A 61-year-old man was found dead in his kitchen in a totally different town. He had also been strangled, and this mystery woman's DNA was found on a kitchen drawer. Same cause of death, DNA match. So the police now suspected that it might have a serial killer.
Right.
It's at this point now, when you open a serial killer case file, that you have to give the serial killer a name.
The Cornflakes or Kellogg's really get her.
The Kellogg Killer.
Kellogg Killer.
And the,
what, they must have, can I have a guess at what they called the net, called her?
Well, the strangling. She was eventually referred to as the Phantom of Heilbronn, but that was until later, and I'll explain where that came from. Before then, she was called the Woman with No Face for a long time when all of the case was going, which is a bit boring. So
I was going to go for the strangling brat first.
Strangling brat first. Yeah. What about Peter Andre's mysterious girl?
Ooh, the suffocating schnitzel.
Ooh, the schnitzel suffocator.
Yeah, the schnitzel suffocator. Let's go for that one.
Or the sauerkraut strangler.
Sauerkraut shackler. Yeah, the sauerkraut. Yes, sauerkraut strangler. I'm happy that we didn't do that thing of you made up a name beforehand and tried to just force a name like you did, that like Gentle Kenneth and Keith, which you could, actually, guys, if you can go back and hear that from a week or so ago, where they made up a name before and they allowed me to name him. I named him Keith, and then they refused to allow me to call him Keith and called him Gentle Kenneth instead. You can actually go and check that out from two episodes back. But yeah, so the sauerkraut strangler, we're here, and so where was she in the first? Because I know a little, tiny bit of German geography. Where was she in her first killing, and where was she in her second killing?
It's not important to know, really. It's not relevant to the case, but know that they are two towns in southern Germany.
But they're quite far apart.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
there was no obvious connection between the locations.
To be fair, right? 8 years, long time to travel. And that is...
Exactly. So, yeah.
You could pretty much travel around the world in a boat on your own and then come back again in that time.
She could have walked.
Yeah, quite easily. So I don't know why that was such a big thing. But yeah. The Sauerkraut Strangler / Phantom of Heilbronn.
We have these two cases 8 years apart, but with similar causes of death, and the DNA found very mysteriously at the scene. But this is now it gets really strange. After that second case, suddenly Gentle Kenneth's DNA starts turning up, and I'm not really going to call him Gentle Kenneth.
Poor Gentle Kenneth, being blamed for everything, isn't he? Strangler at the moment.
We've had two seemingly unrelated cases, 8 years apart, but with the same cause of death. But the linking and very strange part, which leads the police to believe they have a serial killer, is that the same woman's DNA is found at both of them, once on a teacup, once on a drawer in the kitchen. The police are now referring to this killer as the Sauerkraut Strangler. Which then starts to make less sense when we see the crime spree that she goes on after that. So this lady's DNA starts showing up at crime scenes all over southern Germany and in Austria and in France. Jesus. First on a half-eaten cookie, which was found after someone had broke into a caravan.
Is she just doing this on purpose?
Bang, into the caravan, cookie.
She's cleaning up all the other bits apart from just one bit on the crime scene, just to, because she wants
exactly.
to be
it's
known.
Just found just there. Then also on her DNA was found on a discarded heroin syringe. And that syringe was found after a poor 7-year-old stepped on it in a playground. So she's going around using heroin and then leaving them in playgrounds. But she's also breaking into offices. Her DNA was found in an office break-in. And, bizarrely, on a beer and wine glass in a bar that had been burgled. So she broke in, helped herself to a drink. The investigators were at a bit of a loss. They tested the DNA of all of the scenes of crime investigators, all of the they call them like SOCO officers who attend to make sure there hadn't been contamination from one of the investigators, and no matches there. They were stumped. You got any ideas as to who the sauerkraut strangler could have been?
Angela Merkel.
How she operated.
Angela Merkel. Now she's taken over. We've already had one person in jail take over Germany.
You're just naming German women that you know of. It was going to be that or Eva Braun.
I know Diane Kruger. I know... who's the blonde lady? A
couple of the blonde traps.
Mrs. Hitler. I know her.
That's Eva Braun.
Oh, right. this is one of the kind of arguments for having everyone's DNA on file, isn't it? This is one of those. Like, you know, if everyone's DNA was on file earlier on, they would have caught her straight away. But there's also all the other stuff, like you never know who's going to take over, and then therefore could frame you, could do social stuff with your DNA, and also where you're going to store it, it's going to take loads of money, blah blah blah. But the whole point is like this could be a very good case of going, if everyone was on file, they would have got her after the first one in 1993. And did all these cases happen after 2001, by the way, or did all these cases in between?
They weren't in between. Oh, yeah. Okay. So there was two stranglings 8 years apart. And then after the second one in 2001, there was then a flurry. It was like a massive spree. And there's a really weird one that happened after all those I listed. This is a really strange one. A man shot his brother with a pistol, and the Sauerkraut Strangler's DNA was found on some of the bullets. He attested to not know anyone. He didn't claim anyone had helped him load the gun or anything like that. And this happened a few times where there was a series of robberies, armed robberies, all sorts of crimes committed all over the place where DNA was found on the perpetrator. So they knew who committed the crime. They'd caught them, but somewhere on their body was found the DNA of the Sauerkraut Strangler, and no one would talk, no one would say, you know, there was no like, you know, sort of mysterious kingpin who'd been organising these crimes around Europe.
Because she was like, if you tell him it was me, I will get that sauerkraut and I will shove it down your throat just like I did with all my other victims.
Yeah, and they look at her rap sheet and they know she's serious.
Exactly, there's loads of...
only Saint Olga looks tougher than her, really, by comparison.
On her rap sheet as well, it's like, cleaning out my closet, Indie Club, loads of massive hits. They're like, oh shit, she's serious. She knows what she's doing. She's part of that gangster rap.
Well,
in terms of who it is, I obviously don't have a clue, and I feel like this could possibly be a situation where a woman is just getting in trouble, or a guy is doing all this and taking her around this. So some girl's DNA or blood and stuff and spreading it places. That's my guess.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It contaminating the scene to kind of muddy the investigation. And if you've got the same sample, it would confound the police.
Yeah,
that's a good suggestion. Well, I'll tell you the final, I guess, act in the crime spree, and what happened as a fallout of that. And we'll see how it goes. But basically, she committed one more big crime, and that's where she earned the nickname the Phantom of Heilbronn, because in this town of Heilbronn, somebody got into the back of a police car and shot a police officer in the back, killing them, and then shot their partner and severely injured them. This crime then attracted huge attention when the Sauerkraut Strangler, or now the Phantom's DNA, was found both on the back seat and on the dashboard. So having had all these crimes and now committing, you know, murder and serious injury to a police officer, they then issued a €300,000 reward for information about her whereabouts.
Wow.
Then, of course, this huge reward sparked loads of confusion because people want the reward. So at these crime scenes, people start saying, they see this person, that person. I saw somebody. They didn't really look like a woman. They looked like a man. It got so much more confusing in a way. But eventually, after 16 years, 40 crime scenes with her DNA found at, and multiple high-value rewards coming out, they found a dead man. A dead man who'd... the burned remains of a dead man, and his DNA that they'd sampled from his body seemed to be a match for this woman, the Strangler.
What? So he... Had he taken... I was going to say, is he transsexual? And He was originally a woman.
It's way more prosaic than that, and kind of silly. That's when they realised, when they were confronted with the evidence, that it definitely couldn't be this person. This is a dead man, and they've done a sample from him, and the key was the sampling. There was somebody, some woman, who worked in a packing factory that put swabs into kits for police. Her DNA was on 40 swabs that were distributed to southern Germany, Austria, and France, and her DNA turned up at random at crime scenes because it was introduced on a swab and then taken in DNA. And I said, this phantom was exactly that. There was no phantom. She's just doing her job.
She is a phantom because she wasn't even there. She wasn't even there as she was causing these crimes. So she was just shit. She should have been using protective gloves. She should have been using kind of PPE. And she just obviously was just like spitting on everything that she was coming her way. And then she was like, oh, there we go, carry on.
Rather unsatisfyingly, I couldn't get a firm answer to the question as to whether, because some people suggested that the police force was at fault, or the forces were at fault, because they'd been ordering medical grade swabs, which aren't allowed to have any pathogens on them but can have some DNA on them, rather than sort of lab grade swabs, which need to be completely free of DNA. And some people say that she was deliberately contaminating them.
I was going to say, is she working with
them? It was supposed to be clean. And yeah, it's never, they didn't publicly announce who this lady was. They just said, this is the outcome. And maybe to protect this lady's identity, I don't know. But I mean, she could go around committing all sorts of crimes now, and they would just write it off.
Yeah, they'd just be like, she's shit. She's classic. She's still spitting on those swabs. She's still sticking those swabs up her ass. She's just carrying on to what she wants. And we're still not going to sack her.
They found traces of poo on the teacup in this lady's house.
Do you know the first ever DNA conviction and where it was?
Oh, no, a likeness.
It was in Leicester. It was a guy called Colin Pitchfork. Oh. And essentially...
was he chasing after a witch?
Weirdly enough, no, he was a baker. He was a sexual assaulter, and he exposed himself to over like 1,000 women and stuff. And basically, one of Pitchfork's colleagues at the bakery, Ian Kelly, revealed to fellow workers in this like Leicester pub basically that he'd taken some blood tests whilst masquerading as Pitchfork, because Pitchfork was, they thought that it was him, so they were going to try and put in the blood of Pitchfork and say, you know, the DNA evidence between these two different samples match up. And a woman basically just overheard this conversation that his colleague had run up the blood for Pitchfork, and she reported it because she thought it was bad and illegal. And so they then collared him, pulled the blood out, and then they revealed that actually he was the person. He was the first person to be caught by DNA evidence in the world, and it's all done in Leicester. I think it was about late 1980s. Yeah, and obviously now...
It's amazing how much it's used now, yeah. Some people say if you listen very carefully in sort of lower parts of Germany and around the foothills in Austria, you can just hear the echoing, bellowing, reverberating clap of the detective face-palming when they realised that there was no murderer and that it was a completely pointless goose chase with hundreds of thousands of euros offered for... packing factory operative.
Sorry,
you can hear it in the wind.
Sorry, I'm sorry, I missed that bit. So these are just loads of different crimes. There wasn't one murderer. There was loads of different, but sorry.
Yeah, loads of unsolved crimes with contaminated DNA sprayed all over them from.
Fuck me! I did not even realise that. I thought it was this guy that they got the DNA off. No. Mm-mm.
It was just mistakes or deliberate contamination at the factory where they get the swabs from.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's not put that in there. Cause it make me look like an idiot. That's getting edited out. Okay, well, thank you again Thank you again. I didn't even thank you first time. Thank you very much for listening today. If you did like the podcast, obviously, please give this a like and a little subscribe and recommend it to one friend. I have seen people have been recommending them into big group chats that I am in. Don't do that. I make the fucking podcast, Alex. So stop it. Stop sending it to me. I know what's on here, so I don't need to listen to it. And that's a little shout out for one of our friends. Before we go, Buster, do you want to give us a little roundup of what we learned today? Because apparently in the second story, I wasn't listening.
So this week we learned that sometimes practical jokes can go wrong. Even innocent pranks like hijacking a plane and taking it to Cuba or assassinating a half-brother can lead to tragic consequences. And it's where we get the famous saying, the boy who cried font. We also learned that the Phantom of Heilbronn, or the Sauerkraut Strangler, was just that, a phantom, but also the greatest crime spree that's ever happened.
That never did happen.
And it wasn't so great, because one of them was a caravan that got broken into and half a biscuit was stolen, so...
And again, thank you very much for listening, and yes, it is goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.